Chapter 4. Mick. As his musical compatriots descend from decadence to addiction, Mick finds himself unable to resist joining them on this unfortunate exploit. One of my favorite movies is Crossroads, about the legend that Robert Johnson sold his soul to the devil at a Mississippi crossroads one night so that he could play guitar like no man has since. At the end, the devil comes to Robert Johnson in the depths of his unhappiness and gloats, "You got what you wanted. You wanted to be a blues man." I used to tell myself the same thing. You got what you wanted. You wanted to be a rock and roll star. Deal with it. My dreams had come true, but they weren't what I had thought they would be. When we were recording Girls, Tom Zutaut would stop by the studio and see me drunk, slouched over, and knocked out on painkillers. When he first signed us, he used to call me the Purple People Eater because he said I had a purple aura. But now he looked at me distraught. "Your purple people eater is fading," he said sadly. "It's fading into this weird alcoholic thing." "No, it's not," I would mumble back. But it was. When I was recording the staccato guitar line at the end of the song Girls, 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 I fell out of the chair because I was so drunk. Though we used the take anyway because we liked how it sounded and I was in too much pain to play anymore. We had sold millions of records and I was still broke. The rest of the guys were partying and spending all this money on drugs, but I was stuck with lawyers, accountants, and greedy exes coming down on me for child support. When I left for the tour, I kept my car at a friend's house, and not only did he total the right side, but he had the nerve to ask for $500 for car sitting. When you start to get successful, everybody thinks you're rich. Me? I didn't even have enough money to buy another car. And on top of that, I lost the last guy who I had considered to be a real friend. I haven't had one since. Before I went on stage, I'd line up 6 shots of vodka next to an open can of Coke and then down them all. During the show, I'd have a glass of pure vodka on the side, which the other guys thought was water. Afterward, I'd bring out a jar of Marzade, a mix of tequila, orange juice, and grenadine, and suck that down. Alcohol would bring out sides of my personality that I never even knew existed. I was moldy one night at the Lexington Queen in Japan, and the owner happened to have a Godzilla mask. I put it on, hopped on the dance floor, and started doing what we call crack dancing, shaking my ass with my butt crack hanging out of my pants. We used to do a lot of crack bowling, too. I suddenly got inspired to leave the bar with the Godzilla mask on and terrorize unsuspecting Japanese civilians, maybe crush some office buildings, too. I pulled my pants down to my ankles and walked up and down the street barking and snapping at people with my Godzilla mask on. The rest of the guys were chasing after me laughing because they'd never seen me behave like that before. Someone had told me that it's legal in Japan for a man to stop anywhere and pee on the side of the road, so I decided to see if that was true. I thought I was so funny. But when I returned to my hotel room, I looked at myself in the mirror and just saw an ugly, dirty guy with a big, giant belly. Since I had started drinking heavily after Vince's accident, I had slowly been blowing up like a balloon. I was surprised no one pitchforked me and stuck an apple in my mouth. I was such a pig. That's why I should have been suspicious when Emmy Cannon, one of the 2 backup singers we had hired, in emulation of the Rolling Stones with Mary Clayton or Humble Pie with Madeline Bell and Doris Troy, started getting really friendly with me. She was thin, athletic, and beautiful, and I was old, ugly, and sickly. No woman in her right mind would have been attracted to me. The guys had made a rule. You don't shit in your backyard, as Nikki explained it, and you don't sleep with anybody who works with you. So when they started hearing Emmy's voice coming from my room at all hours, they flipped out. The Jack Daniels and Halcyon made them blind with rage, and they punished us much more than we deserved. They stopped talking to us, gave us dirty looks, poured drinks on us, and smeared food all over our luggage. Emmy was very religious, and they showed her no mercy. Whenever the plane hit turbulence during the tour, they'd stand up, drop their pants to their ankles, and start chanting, "Fuck God, let's crash," just to make her freak out, grab her crucifix necklace, and start crossing herself and praying. If I tried to stop them, they'd heave a bottle of Jack at me. It was so hypocritical because before we had hired Emmy and Donna McDaniel, the other backup singer in the Nasty Habits, we were working with a vocalist named Bree Howard. She had a dirty, bluesy voice like Tina Turner and had sung with Robbie Neville and toured with Jimmy Buffett. But just as she was about to join the band, Nikki started dating her. I was disillusioned and disgusted that Nikki and the guys came down so hard on me after that. I guess they lost all the faith and trust they had in me, and I definitely lost any faith and trust I had in them as friends and bandmates. If I didn't love playing guitar so much, I would have walked out on them. I've always been ready to crawl back to where I came from. Most people aren't. They think bad things only happen to other people. That's why I try to rely only on myself. Anything could happen to our society, and probably will, from a massive earthquake to a nuclear attack to a stock market crash. Most people say, "Oh, I have a great job, plenty of money, good benefits, and medical coverage. I feel great and safe." But what if a depression or a food shortage raised the price of bread to $50? How would you feed your family? Could you survive as your ancestors did? Unlikely. When you're running around begging for scraps of food, drugs, and girls suddenly don't seem so important. I never really got into the decadence or the pampering or the hard drugs like the rest of the band did. They used to call me 8-Ball Mars because I'd say, "Give me an 8-Ball and don't ask me why." I was new to cocaine, and when it became a problem, I stopped. Not like Nikki. I was mad as hell when I first saw him doing heroin. We were playing at the Long Beach Arena on the Shout at the Devil tour, and he was sniffing a little bindle. I asked, "What the fuck was that?" He said it was smack, and I asked, "Have you started shooting that shit?" He said that he would never do that, but I was fucking livid. I knew exactly what was going to happen to him, and during the girls' tour, it did. But how can you save someone like that from himself? No one could stop me from drinking and swelling up. No one could stop Elvis from the pills that killed him. That's what I thought when I got the call between legs of the tour telling me what I already feared. Our tour manager was shit-faced, high, and crying when he broke the news to me. He asked me to call England and cancel the European leg of the tour for him. Why me? I was hungover, confused, upset, and mad. At Nikki and at myself for not doing more to stop him. I called Kerrang! Magazine and said the first thing that came to my head. "We can't come over because we heard you have severe storms over there and, we have so much equipment that we are afraid that it could cause a cave-in because, there is snow on the roof or something." I didn't know what I was talking about. All I knew was that I couldn't tell them what Rich had really told me. Nikki was dead.